This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. We built the Scotland Outdoors podcast out of the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland. And this week, we had all sorts of things on the go, to be honest. Trees started off as a Scottish Tree of the Year, became a UK Tree of the Year. Could it be a European Tree of the Year? We will find out. I need to explain to you why there is a smile in my voice this morning. It has been a couple of really miserable days weather-wise. It's been raining very heavily. The rain's gone off, which has cheered me up a wee bit, but that's not the whole thing. About 15 minutes ago, a car pulls into the car park, and out steps Sandy Bremner, formerly of this parish, former news editor here, with homemade clouty dumpling, still warm, out of the pot, individually wrapped. Now, he is a wise man. He was bearing gifts. God bless him. You know, and we've passed it round and we've had it, and it's just really that one random act of kindness has brought a big smile to my face this morning. 40 miles to the north, clouty dumplingless. I can't even. Is that a word? Probably not. Mr. Ewan McElwraith.
Yeah, sitting here looking at an empty plate and trying not to feel bitter. Yeah, it's dark, it's damp, there's not a trace of wind. It's a really, you can almost cut the atmosphere out there. It is incredible. I think it's only 9 days to go till the shortest day, though, so there is light on the horizon. And we're bringing you light through the radio. If you're up and about, tell us what you're doing. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number's 80295. Lewis is sitting beside the phone, just waiting to be cheered up. You can call him on 08 085 92 95 00.
Yes, in this performance of A Christmas Carol, the role of Tiny Tim will be played by Mr. Ewan McElwraith, the small child with the empty plate. If you have tears, prepare to shed them. Coming up, how practical is it to have an outdoor Christmas? Team member Jim Muatoni assesses whether his garden gazebo is up for the job of hosting this year's festivities. My guess is probably not. And Scotland is heading to Europe, not the football team this time, but our Tree of the Year, which will be representing Great Britain. We're going to be finding out all about that.
Yeah, and we have high hopes of that. And, of course, there is the mystery bird. And this week, it is impossible. I challenge anybody to tell me what this is. And if you've got an idea what that is, get in touch. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, and prove me wrong on 08 085 92 95 00.
As ever, we're keen to hear what you think of the programme on our Scotland Outdoors podcast. One of our recent podcasts focused on the subject of the direct link between slavery-derived wealth and land ownership in the Highlands and Islands. And we got quite some correspondence on that. Helen from Edinburgh said, "Hi, Outdoors. Just wanted to get in touch to thank you for an excellent podcast and programme interview. I feel like I was brought up in a parallel universe, in that it's only in the last few years that I've started to learn just how fundamental slavery was to the history and traditions of the UK. Yes, I grew up near Liverpool and knew it was a city that had benefited from the trade, like Glasgow and Bristol. But why were we never told that profits from slavery lie behind so many of our institutions, and that its tentacles even influence the Highland clearances, the way we manage our land, and so much more? It's obvious once you start to look."
Yeah, and Peter Kershaw got in touch. He said, thank you for such a compelling interview with Drs. MacKillop and MacKinnon. It's a story that needed to be told and highlighted, and it was done in an extremely moving manner.
I don't know whether you heard of it. At the time, we asked Scottish Land and Estates for a response, which they duly provided, to which Ian MacKinnon, one of the authors of the report, subsequently replied, saying, Sarah Jane Lang of Scottish Land and Estates states, this was from their, you know, the Scottish Land and Estates statement, indeed, the authors of this paper admit themselves there are few, if any, families in the area who are major landowners today and who have any past connection to slavery. End of quote. Ian replies, for the record, and in particular regard to the use of if any, we didn't say this, and it's not true. Drawing on Andy Whiteman's figures, published in 1996, I estimate that at least 400,000 acres in the western and northern highlands and islands were still owned by families with historical connections to slavery at the beginning of the 21st century.
And if you're interested in hearing that podcast, and trust me, I'm just saying it because Mark and I were involved, it is fascinating. You can get it on BBC Sounds.
Anyway, this weekend in the depths of winter, surprisingly, there is a fungal, probably rather squelchy, fungal foray in Angus.
Yeah, it surprised me as well, but it's happening at Hospital Field near Arbroath, and it's a magnificent, if somewhat eccentric house with gardens that go back hundreds of years. We're going to hear a bit later in the programme about the fungus walk, but first I met Kirsten Wilson, who's looking after a project to turn the clock back 800 years at the house and the gardens.
At the moment, we're standing in the walled garden at Hospital Field House, and behind you is the building which was built by Patrick and Elizabeth Allen Fraser in the Victorian era.
It's a strange mix of architecture, isn't it? There's turrets and there's all kinds of things.
Yes, Patrick was a real lover for the sort of theatrical and really believed in the arts and crafts style and supporting craftspeople. So the intricate carvings that you see and the nods to different types of architecture were really his interests.
And it's an absolute mess of a garden. You know, we've got this fantastic walled garden that's, I don't know, a couple of acres. It is really impressive. You would never know it's here, but it's a bit of a mess.
You're seeing it at the messy stage. We're right in the middle of a massive capital development project, which is a £5.5 million project here in Angus to redevelop this walled garden. We've been working with Nigel Dunnett, and he's trying to capture the 800 years of history for this garden. And we're also building a new hub for Angus, really a cultural hub. So we have a new cafe and atrium space, and we're going to be really opening up to more and more visitors in 2021.
Must be quite challenging trying to recapture something that was 600-800 years old. You must be almost working in the dark to a certain extent.
Yes, he was really. He was using a lot of artistic license through research of what would have happened in monastic gardens and Victorian gardens and what would have been here, because we don't have records to show how the gardens would have looked. So areas of it which are nods to the formal monastic garden, a kind of potager style, mixing herbs with vegetables and other plants. But really, Nigel Dunnett's brought through his own individual style of gardening, which is very much about sustainability.
And you've got a bit of a blank canvas to work on.
Yes, a blank canvas here. There wasn't much left from the original. We did have a lot of volunteers working with us on the garden and did a lot of work to restore what was there. But the design was really a kind of 1970s design with not much kind of planning and thought. So this is a real move to the future, really.
So have you got a picture in your mind what it might look like when it's finished?
I do have a picture in my mind because of Nigel's work. He's designed gardens at the Barbican, and he really believes in this new perennial movement. So,
what's a new perennial movement?
So it's a kind of garden design style that's been championed by people like Piet Udolf in the Netherlands, and it's really about thinking about the garden through the seasons. So it's low intervention planting, so that there's succession, that things self-seed and grow, and not cutting everything back and keeping things really tidy every winter. So today we've got a great team of garden volunteers local to Angus that have come along to help us plant over 5,000 bulbs.
Wow. So how do you manage to get volunteers to do that?
Well, I think we've got a great asset here. It's quite a unique space. People enjoy spending time here.
Well, I get it, midsummer on a hot day. You know, here we are in December. It's a quagmire and it's not particularly warm. How do you inspire folk to get out there and start planting?
I think people are really keen to be outdoors. There are a lot of them are gardeners themselves and home gardeners, but they don't necessarily have that social aspect. So coming along to Hospital Field, working with the team here, working with our new head gardener, Kate Robinson, and working with this exciting new garden is an opportunity for them to be involved. It's very exciting for me and everybody at Hospital Field just to be able to have a new garden to offer visitors. And with the cafe and the restoration of the studio buildings that we're working on here, it's a very exciting time.
Now, you've also got an odd-looking building over there. It's a lovely building, a lovely red sandstone. But it's what's inside it that's fascinating, or what will be and what was.
Yeah, we're currently restoring a Victorian fernery on that site.
What's a fernery?
A fernery is a house or a kind of glass house to hold a collection of ferns. Patrick and Elizabeth Allen Fraser, who owned the house, built that to house their collection of ferns.
So you would have to heat that, presumably?
Not necessarily. It can't get too cold and it can't get too hot, but some ferns kind of can survive in a glasshouse environment that's not too heated.
Is that going to be quite a challenge to recreate that?
It is a challenge. It's been designed as part of our cafe extension by architects Caruso St John. So it's got the original stonework and they've restored all that Victorian stonework internally, and it's almost like a grotto, so there's lots of gaps and spaces for the ferns to be housed. And we're working with the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh to grow and propagate all the ferns that are going to be inside of it. And then the roof will be glass.
And you've got a mushroom walk this Saturday.
That's right. We've got Jim Cook of the Tayside Fungus and Mushroom Group coming along and leading a walk through the grounds.
Well, Laura's out there at the moment trying to find some mushrooms, so we'll see where it goes, and I wish you every success.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to it.
Kirsten Wilson, their engagement and volunteer programme manager at Hospital Field House in Arbroath. And we've got more from Hospital Field after the news. I was trying to think where it was. I'd seen a really good fernery. Is it in Benmore? Across on the west coast.
I've never been to a fernery. It was a whole new one on me, and it just springs. Why would you do that? What's the attraction of a fern?
Oh, they're beautiful things. I'm trying to remember why they do it. They take fern fronds and they place them on pieces of paper because the spores come off them. And if you leave it, the spores drop down. And if you pick the leaf off very, very carefully, what you end up with is almost like a print. And I'm sure, you know, you get that fixative that artists use for charcoal drawings. You kind of spray it on.
I've got some just beside me.
You've got some. It wouldn't be at all, but it keeps the hair down. But they use that to sort of fix it. I'm sure somebody did a series of prints about that. But, I mean, they're beautiful, beautiful things.
Yeah. You can do it with mushrooms as well. That's how you identify some of the mushrooms. You take the print of the spores, and it'll give you indication of which species you're looking at. Yeah. Perhaps Laura does that later on, but I doubt it.
This is really the real value of this programme, isn't it? You know, folk can tune into this and hear two presenters who can nearly remember what the story is. Just about.
I think that's the joy of it. You know, most programmes have experts. We speculate.
We can keep going for hours on this basis. This week, we heard the news that scientists say that the weight of human-made objects will likely exceed that of living things by the end of the year. In other words, the combined weight of all the plastic, bricks, concrete and other things we've made in the world will outweigh all animals and plants on the planet for the very first. That's a scary thought.
It is.
Yeah, not good. With that in mind, and as we head towards Christmas, we decided to rerun this from December last year when I revisited Murray Wastebusters. Now, it's in forests. It's a social enterprise and charity whose main aim is to reduce waste going to landfill by diverting it and selling it on a fair price. Now, they do that all year round, but they go big, big at Christmas time. They've actually got a Christmas store. Manager Phil Mills was on hand to show me around what was a veritable wonderland.
We're heading towards Murray Wastebusters Christmas Grotto.
Now, is this actually retrieved out of the skips?
No. This is donated by the public.
Okay.
Some of it is new in the box.
Yeah. I mean, just looking around the place, there are Santa sacks, you've got baubles, you've got decorations, you've got wreaths.
We've got onesies, we've got hats.
Christmas onesies. I seldom think of Christmas without thinking of onesies.
Yeah, lots and lots of Christmas trees, pre-lit ones, seem to have been very popular this year. We did have a table that was toys, that, you know, brand new toys.
Brand new?
Yeah. They were new in box. That's something that we're going to try and do more of next year, is actually make a better collection of unwanted gifts that we get through that have never been opened.
What's the weirdest thing that you've been to date?
What, to do with Christmas? Or?
Yeah, well, let's keep it with Christmas.
Oh, I'll tell you what, we look out the door. Uh-huh. Well, that's pretty weird, isn't it? But never mind, the snow globe. But
oh, no, wow. No,
let's just describe this. It is an inflatable plastic globe with Merry Christmas written across the bottom. And there are two snowmen inside, and it is snowing little polystyrene balls.
And that's not the end of it.
Oh?
I reach around the back here. Uh-huh. And if I find the switch...
Oh, where is it? Oh. Oh, yes. I'm not leaving without that. Seriously, I am having that. That's brilliant, that is. I know the very person that's going to get that. And hell mend her, I say.
Excellent. Oh, yes, and look.
Christmas stock, all half price.
So there you are, £2.50. Sold.
So, yeah, that's a lot of fun for £2.50, I'm telling you.
Absolutely. Well, one of the strangest things we've got this Christmas, we walked past earlier on. Uh-huh. You can see in the distance there.
Oh, that looks as if it came off a pantomime or something.
It has.
Cinderella's
it has,
coach?
It has, yes. We've had about three or four through the year of items that have come from local theatrical groups, and they've handed them on. Lots of chariots.
We've offered this on Facebook, this current panto chariot, there's the word. Uh-huh. We've offered it on Facebook free to a local school or group for their pantomimes or their nativity performances.
Yeah. Or whatever performance they've been doing through the year.
I have to do with it. Yeah,
the Virgin Mary and Joseph arrived at the inn in a pull-along gold coach. I remember it well.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, the donkey obviously can pull it, you know. And the tinsel just makes it.
Absolutely. Well, you're not selling the donkey too.
No. We get most things, but not donkeys.
Not live animals.
Oh, we have had live animals before.
Hamsters, yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah, we've had hamsters, haven't we?
Yes, they unfortunately got dumped with a little sad little note saying, "Live hamsters, please look after us." Uh-huh. And we nearly chucked them out. It's two little dwarf hamsters, isn't it? Rivorskis, that's it.
Yeah, we didn't nearly chuck them out on purpose.
No.
By accident.
Oh, no, no. They were
I can't be bothered with that.
Yes, that was it. And there's a fight amongst the staff as to who got to take them home. So, but they had a good life, didn't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
They were good little guys.
Yeah, they went home with
Was
Linnie,
it Anna and Elsa, wasn't it?
Was it Linnie they went home with?
Yes, because I already had one.
Yeah. And aside from the Christmas stuff, what's the weirdest thing you've ever had through here?
Oh, my goodness.
Aside from the hamsters, obviously.
Keep it clean, Laura.
I can't say what it was.
I'm not sure, actually. We get so many remarkable things.
Every day is like Christmas here. You open a box, isn't it? You open a box, you have no idea what it is, and they take out the stuff, and you're amazed at it. You're amazed that folk chuck this stuff out, and that it's going to come here and have another chance at life and being useful.
That's right. I mean, I've already started to stock up the auction container. I don't remember the last time
you came. Yes, I remember
it
well, yeah.
Well, that's already started to stock up again with kind of unusual and maybe collectible things.
Yeah.
So we've got a double bass. We've got...
haven't we? Yes.
Yeah.
Musical instruments are strong this year.
Yeah, we've got quite a lot of interesting hi-fi and musical things, vintage stuff. And we're going to... Actually, when this Christmas grotto's finished, in the new year, we're going to have a hi-fi sale, because we've got some high-end hi-fi. It might be, not current, but some interesting stuff. So that'll come through. But in the auction, we've got some vintage musical instruments and electrical stuff.
All manner of things.
Yeah.
I think it's great that you've got something like this, which is giving a second, a third, possibly a fourth life.
Absolutely.
To stuff. Otherwise, we'd just have ended up in landfill.
Well, interesting, there were some vintage Christmas decorations. Now, they're really quite something. I mean, they went very quickly, obviously. But, you know, they're kind of quality items there. Maybe collectible, I don't know.
Yeah. It's making that Christmas more affordable for folk,
Absolutely.
That can't necessarily, because there's a Christmas tree there, it's a fiver, it lights up, job's a good one.
Yeah, pretty lit. In the box, actually, that one hadn't been used.
Uh-huh.
Is that
fine? Yeah. See, joking aside about, the question of taste and what have you, as far as I'm concerned, the brighter it is, the jazzier it is, well, the Christmas. More it lights up,
Absolutely.
That's Christmas.
Absolutely, oh, wow. Absolutely.
Oh, wow, yeah, this is what this place is about. We have a blast putting this together. This is our favourite time of year, is getting this and going through all the container at the back and all the bits and bobs that we get in. Mm. Honestly, you just think, God... And honestly, the staff can buy quite a lot of stuff. We try not to buy everything because you can. Otherwise, there'd be nothing left. And I'm actually on a ban for my husband this year. So, no more Christmas stuff.
Stop it.
I've snuck a few things in, but you'll never know.
Yeah.
We love coming in here and just spending an hour. I spent Saturday in here the whole day and just had a blast.
It keeps us going through this cold spell as well, doesn't it? It's a bit of a highlight for ourselves.
And folks come in and they're awfully cheery. They're all well, in the festive form, aren't they? They're all happy and it's really nice. It's a nice community sort of feel sometimes, especially this time of year.
Well, I need to go and get my wallet because I genuinely want those snowmen.
I'll pack it
away. Yeah, pack it up, Laura. Yeah.
No! It's gone off.
What have you done? What have you done?
I didn't touch it. Oh, gosh. Off button. There we are.
Laura Young and Phil Mills from Murray Wastebusters and Forests and their Christmas Grotto. Can't recommend it highly enough. What a laugh that was. Great fun.
And stunningly hideous. I remember when you brought it in. Did you manage to palm it off on anybody or have you still got it?
It still exists. And one of the things we discovered, because they packed it up in the box, and we discovered that the signpost that says North Pole actually is hinged halfway up because otherwise it wouldn't fit in the box. So within the plastic globe, you had to go, because it's a soft plastic globe, you had to kind of bend it up, slot it into position, and then there's lights at the top of the pole and the snow fires out the top. I tell you, for £2.50, the fun we've had out of that, fantastic. Great stuff.
It's one of those things you're going to be giving, you probably have given it to somebody, and then in 5 years' time it will end up coming back to you because it is such a hideous thing.
I think it's brilliant. Listen, continuing our long-running theme of making people maudlin and greet around the world, you've got a comment from far, far away.
Yeah, Doug Holmes said, listening for once in a slightly murky Hong Kong. And for us, it's a chilly 21 degrees.
Wow.
Love listening to the podcast during the week. Keeps me up to date with what's happening in the natural world of my long-distant homeland. That's Doug.
And I've got one that more or less matches. It's Brian in Shanghai saying, hello, guys. As always, I'm tuning in from the Far East. I've just returned to Shanghai from Hong Kong, and I'm sitting doing my 14 days isolation in a small hotel room in Pudong, Shanghai. Not been home to Gurek since February, and no chance of getting onto the Cairngorms until possibly June, July. The Duke of Edinburgh's award expeditions went up in smoke this year, fingers crossed for 2021. He wants to say hello to Will at Calata Lodge and says, we should do a broadcast from there at Loch Calata. And adds, you guys stay safe and keep the quality programmes coming. Lang me a lum reek, Brian Hopkins. Same to you, Brian. You're listening to BBC Radio Scotland and Out of Doors, the programme that isn't spreading Christmas cheer. No, we make people greet. I'm Mark Stephen, and of course, Mr. Ewan McElraith is here, teasing us once again on a weekly basis with the Mystery Bird.
Yeah, I think...
You weren't quick enough there.
Well, we do have... Yeah, I know. You'll be quick off the mark here. We do have some guesses, but none correct so far. If you've any idea what that is, I don't know, should we give a clue here?
Oh, go on, give it a go.
I don't know, we might dip into it later on. We can text 80295, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, and the phone number 08085 92 95 00. Lewis is here taking your calls.
Christmas is inevitably going to be a bit different this year in lots of ways. I would imagine just about everybody's had the discussion about how to spend Christmas Day itself, who with, how, you know, just physically how you're going to do it. Our colleague Jim Muatoni has been mulling over a few outdoor ideas.
With only 2 weeks to go to Christmas, 9 months into this pandemic and the restrictions that we have to work under, I've been spending a lot of time in my gazebo, my all-weather gazebo in the garden where I can work. The Wi-Fi extends to there. And now I'm considering whether, with the various restrictions that we have to work under in level 3 now in suburban Glasgow, and with the family desperate to spend time with Granny and Grandpa, who are in their mid-80s and have underlying health problems, I'm thinking, could we do Christmas out of doors? It's a family affair. Well, I suppose the first thing within the guidelines is the idea of us staying kind of socially distanced while we're here. The gazebo itself is 3 metres by 3 metres square. And the great thing is it has removable sides. So let's measure the table and just check how big the table is and how far Granny and Grandpa might be able to be away from us. Right. So, measuring tape. Yeah. So we're looking about 160 for the table. You've got another circular table, smaller one, which is 1 metre diameter. So yes, Granny and Grandpa could go here at one end, at a circular table, sheltered with the three ends. And our table could be 2 metres away from them at this other open end. Yeah, so that's possible. Then from there, I suppose the major thing that we do is our Christmas dinner. So they'll have to bring their own cutlery and their own plates and their own booze and stuff and keep all that. But that's achievable. One of the things we love to do at Christmas, just sit round and watch some telly together. And, you know, fall asleep whilst watching it. That might not be what happens when you're out of doors doing it, but teenage daughter does have one of those kind of projectors that connects the Bluetooth to her phone. So basically everything that's on her phone, we can use the projector to project onto the side of the shed that I work in all the time. And yeah, TV sorted. Brilliant. Now, because the kitchen really leads onto the patio, shouldn't be really any problem in cooking all the bits and bobs that we have in our kind of traditional Christmas dinner and bringing them out here. Just as a question of navigating the sometimes slidey decking in my socks and sliders, which my teenage daughter says is okay, that's a thing, it's quite cool now to wear socks, sliders. And if needed, keeping sauces and plates and other bits and bobs warm, that can happen on the barbecue that we've got right next to our table and patio. So yep, tick for that. Now, you can't have Christmas out of doors without a special soundtrack. And you know what? With the various bits of technology that I've put into place, extenders, means that the Wi-Fi works out here on the patio quite well. So I can use the smart speaker that I've got to play our Christmas tunes, our favourite Christmas tunes, and provide a soundtrack to our celebrations. Now, obviously we're going to be out of doors, but the most important thing in enjoying being out of doors, I think, is just to be prepared for whatever the weather throws at us. So Granny and Grandpa are the same. So it will be gloves. It's slightly difficult to eat with, but you know, you can certainly hold a fork and a spoon and a knife with gloves on. Hats, scarves. Yep, don't see any problems with that. So, yeah, it looks like we could do something that will allow us to enjoy Christmas out of doors.
Jim Muatoni there, prepping for an al fresco Christmas, and this is an indication of how far from cool I actually am. What are sliders? In my day, it was something to do with ice cream vans.
Hey, that's what I thought. Isn't it to do with socks?
I don't know. Flip-flop things. We're getting a voice in my head, which happens occasionally, saying flip-flops. Is it flip-flops? I don't know.
Yeah, if you know. 0808 592 95 00. Joy's been in touch. She said, just to confirm, there's a Victorian fernery at Ascog on Bute.
Okay. I've never been to that one. That's quite an interesting one. Anyway, coming up, foraging for fungus in our broth, the remarkable story of a woman who was made homeless, and of course, our mystery bird. Here's another wee clip. See, I think it's extremely difficult this week, and therefore I've got an enormous amount of sympathy with Gary and Pennycook, who reckons it was a house martin. That's actually not a bad guess, Ewan, is it?
No, he's in the ballpark, but in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
You think more kind of streams,
yeah.
Rivers, little rivers.
Ian and Contour reckons the Mr. Bird was a tree creeper, so again, he's off it there. Lynn D'Agostino in Fife says, good morning, is the bird a cedar waxwing? I've never heard of a cedar waxwing. Also, you should pay a visit to Remake in Creef, an absolutely wonderful place run by volunteers along the same lines as the place you visited in Murray, recycling everything under the sun. That's Murray Wastebusters and Forests, Remake in Creef. And Bill and Kirkcaldy reckons that the noise might have been a green linnet.
Yeah, I mean, they're all the right ballpark, but the tree creeper, I'm just trying, how much to give away?
Don't.
It's that kind of size. That kind of size.
I would have said it was a bit bigger, actually.
A little bit bigger, yeah.
Who
yeah.
were we talking to was talking about the fact, was it tree creepers? There's a particular type of tree. It was, John Lister Kay. John Lister Kay, remember we were looking at a type, or was it the Wellingtonia?
Yes.
And it almost has like little armpits in it up running up the bark, and the tree keepers go right up inside these little holes and flatten themselves, you know, and almost disappear into the bark. Something along those lines, anyway. Right, earlier this week, it was announced that the winner of Scotland's Tree of the Year, a rowan tree in the Carafran Wood, Carifran Wood near Moffat, beats me, gone by the name of the Survivor, has also been crowned Great Britain's Tree of the Year. We'll hear the story of the Survivor Tree soon, but first, joining us to tell us more about this particular honour and what it means is Jill Donaghy from the Woodland Trust. Good morning, Jill. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good, thanks, Ian. Good.
I'm glad to hear it. Listen, you joined us in the programme back in May when nominations for Tree of the Year opened. How were entries this year? Give us some idea of what came in.
Well, yeah, I can't believe it's been May since I was last on. But yeah, in May we called for the nominations of special trees. I mean, it was during lockdown, obviously. And we didn't have hundreds of entries, but we had many more entries than we had in 2019. And the most interesting thing was that many of the trees had a kind of resilience theme. So just like the winner, the survival tree, the trees that were nominated were demonstrating kind of resilience and kind of, you know, survival, just like the winning tree. And I suppose just like the population were at the time in 2020. So that was really interesting. And after the nomination phase, we produced our judging panel produced a shortlist of five, and then they were voted on in September. We had loads more votes than we normally do as well, so that may well be a sign that people were paying a bit more attention to what was in their environment. And then obviously we selected the winner in October, which you'll hear about shortly.
Yeah, but who decides that? Is it a public vote or just a wee cabal of
tree experts? Public vote for the winner for each country in the UK. So Scotland, England and Wales this year participated. So the winner was decided on a public vote. And then of those three winners from Scotland, England and Wales, it was actually the Woodland Trust kind of conservation team that put together a little steering group, and they selected which of those three trees should represent Great Britain in the European competition. And this year it was the Scotland tree which was selected, which is great, fantastic.
So what ones did it beat from the rest of the country? You've got the Happy Man tree, the Chapterhouse tree.
That's right, yeah, and both very, very, very different kind of trees. The Happy Man tree, sadly, is no longer with us, so that tree was a symbol of kind of survival for a very short amount of time. That was in Hackney in London, and it has been earmarked for felling, sadly. So that's now been felled. And the other tree was the Chapterhouse tree, a very historic tree in Port Talbot in Wales. So very, very different. The three trees are very, very different. And I guess the survival tree represented something a bit, it's a hope, it's a symbol of hope really, and a display of what trees can do to our landscape at a time when we've got these climate and biodiversity crises. And I'm sure Fee will tell you a bit more about why that tree is special shortly, but I guess that's what trumped it for our judging panel and what made them nominate that one for Europe.
I don't know this for a fact, Joel, but I would be astonished if some trees on the H2S route hadn't been nominated.
Yeah. Well, they have been in the past, actually, Ewan, and this year we have had quite a lot of nominations in England for HS2, and this year the one that won was the Happy Man tree, which then was sadly felled as well. So, yeah, it's a competition that does highlight these issues that exist in our society and how difficult it is to get trees and woods going in some places. Yeah.
The Survivor Tree, our Tree of the Year, is going through to contend for European Tree of the Year 2021 in February. How does that work? Is there another cabal in operation?
Oh, there is, it is truly like the Eurovision Song Contest, as we've said before. So the European Tree of the Year is part of a family of Tree of the Year contests across the continent of Europe. And I think there's 16 countries that are part of that now. So in February 2021... everybody will be nominated to vote for their favourite European tree, and of course we will be hoping that Scotland votes for the Survivor tree, of course. But yeah, it's essentially another vote off to see who wins.
Have we ever won the European Tree of the Year before? Because we've had some great ones with the Ding Dong Tree in Preston Pans, the Poker Tree, I think, was at Aberfoyle. Just some brilliant, brilliant trees and amazing stories. The Suffragette Oak in Glasgow. We must be due to win it.
That would be great, wouldn't it? Yeah. No, we have never won it before, although the Welsh, there was a tree in Wales that did win it once a couple of years ago. But no, I'm afraid our colleagues in Eastern Europe seem to be very good at pulling out the big trees and getting the masses and masses of votes. So, no, we've never won it. Maybe 2021 will be the year. Who knows?
I think it's fascinating what you were saying earlier about the fact that, you know, many more people participated this year, and, you know, there's a recurrent theme of survival, of permanence. You know, folk were really looking for something to hang on to, and something in their community that lasts many, many human generations is an ideal candidate.
Absolutely, and long may that continue. So I do think that this year there has been, for some people certainly, they've spent more time outdoors and been more aware of what's in their environment. For others, perhaps not. But I think it's actually a demonstration of the nation's resilience as much as the trees.
Yeah, so we're looking for Écosse 10 points. When it comes to the cabal. Listen, Joel, thank you very much for joining us for that. Right now, we've also got, with the story of the winning tree, the Survivor, Fee Martinoga from the Borders Forest Trust. Good morning, Fee. How are you?
Morning.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here. You nominated this rowan tree. Just describe it for us first, and then tell us why you nominated it.
It's a very modest round tree that's growing out of a steep bank on the side of the Carifron Burn. And 20 years ago, when we found the site, it was really the only tree that you could see easily in the whole valley. I mean, there were others, but they were hidden down in deep clefts. And there was this one tree. And there were people around being very sceptical about it, our plans to put trees back into the valley. They said, oh, you'll never get anything going there. And we said, look at that, we will. And, of course, we have. So we used it on a brochure. We said, where one tree survives, a million will grow. And Borders Forest Trust, over the site of Carifron and the other two big sites that we've got, which we call together the Wild Heart of Southern Scotland, we have planted now more than a million trees. So it's more than just the trees. It's a symbol of what you can do if you put your mind to trying to restore an environment.
What are you going to do with the valley? Are you putting native trees in? What's the plan?
Yeah, entirely native. We were very lucky in a bow, a prehistoric bow was found up on the top of the site, and they did core sampling and got an amazing pollen record. It's apparently the best pollen record for Britain, and spans thousands of years. So we know what was growing there at the sort of height of of woodland vegetation after the last ice age. And we've let that guide us into what we could try again. And we've got the full range of natives that you would expect.
How do you pronounce the name of the valley again?
Ah, well, in many ways. I mean, we often just say Carifran because that's how it's spelled. But it's Carifran, and it's actually got three syllables, Carifran. And it really means the place of the ravens.
Okay. It's one of those words. When I heard it for a start, I thought, that sounds remarkably like Welsh.
It is.
It is.
It's Prytonic. It's Old Welsh, because that's where that language extended quite a long way north, a couple of thousand years ago. So,
I love this idea of, you know, there is one survivor, and from where one survivor can, you know, where one can survive, a million others could grow. Great.
Yeah.
Wonderful strapline, wonderful project idea. Any idea why it managed to survive there? Just one tree?
Yes, indeed. It's because of its location. I mean, the problem with the valley was that it was bitten to the quick, like every other sheep pasture in upland Scotland, really. It was so bare. I mean, it was rocks and very low grass. And this tree was coming out of a steep bank and growing a bit like a sabre, so animals just couldn't get at it. There were sheep around and there were feral goats, and they couldn't get anywhere near it. So there it was, and probably, you know, at least 200 years old, I should think. Quite gnarly.
Do you think it's got... think it's got any chance of winning at all? Because at the end, it's just a scabby rowan tree, isn't it?
It's a scabby rowan tree. Now, if we can build up this... this idea that it does show you what you can do if you persevere. I hope so, and I think we've just got to try and galvanise people. So we really need to whip them up in February to vote for us.
And the strapline for that will be, if we can win with a scrappy rowan tree, we can do anything.
Well, that's a good one, thank you. We'll try it.
Or scabby, you know, whatever. Listen, Fee, pleasure speaking to you as ever. Thank you very much for joining us, and also
thank
Jill.
Thank you indeed. Bye-bye.
No problem. So keep your eye open for that, actually, because it'd be worthwhile voting on that. It'd be hilarious if we managed to win it.
I think the odds are slightly against it, but because we've seen quite a few of them. There's a great story. I mean, remember the bicycle tree in Fife?
Yeah.
That somebody left a bike just leaning up against the tree, and the tree's grown around it.
Yeah.
So the bike's embedded in the trees. So many fantastic stories.
Somebody posted something to me the other day on social media, and it was a series of no trespassing signs south of the border that the tree was actually consuming. You know, the tree was growing around these old Victorian signs. And it's a lovely thing to see that kind of thing. Anyway.
It's the odd thing, Mark, is when you actually see, if you're down in England, you see the no trespassing signs.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, I always take a double take. What's that about? Yeah. And then you forget we have a very different system of access up here.
No, it's interesting. The last time I was down south, and you know, and I stopped just to go, I think I stopped to go for a run. And I you know, parked at the bottom of the road. It was like a forestry track. And it wasn't that I was actually running. I thought, am I allowed to do this? And that's a weird, weird feeling. I haven't thought along those lines in many, many years. We are lucky. There's no
question. Well, remember when we were doing the St Cuthbert's Way, we very childishly, and pity anybody who saw us, that we're right on the border, dancing into England. We can't camp here. We can camp here.
Yeah, sad but true. Anyway, we heard earlier from Ewan about the ambitious plans for the gardens at Hospital Field House in Arbroath. Laura Guthrie went along as well to try her hand at having a look for fungus.
My name's Jim Cook, and I'm a member of the Tayside and Fife Fungal Group. We're standing in front of Hospital Field House, and it's got some great grounds around it that we're going to be looking for some fungi. I happen to notice there's an old birch tree over there. I don't know whether you can see it.
Oh, yes,
And there looks like birds' nests or squirrels' drays or something in it. That's actually fungus.
Oh, really?
It's a thing called witch's broom.
Ah.
And it's characteristic, and it only grows on birch or parasitises birch and causes these overgrowths. They're literally galls. So that's one that you can recognise from a great distance away. And, of course, that's the thing. Here in this time of the year, it's terrible for fungi generally, but you can always find something. And, in fact, you're standing beside a stump there and you can see there's... Well, they've had the end of their lifespan but they're pretty well as tough as old boots. They're clumped together, and they've got very characteristic sort of orangey-brown heads with black stalks, which is the giveaway. And, in fact, it's a thing called winter fungus. Comes out late on in the year, which, of course, explains why they're there. All the rest, the soft fungi are long since gone. But it's amazing what you can still see.
And is this the perfect place to find it? This is a tree stump that's obviously been a stump for quite a long time. It's
yes.
covered in mosses as well.
It is, particularly at this time of year. In fact, nothing to do particularly with the tree stump, but round the other side here, I just happened to notice there's an orangey
bit. Oh, wow, yes.
Quite bright orange. And in fact, looks a little bit like orange peel. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep.
And in fact, funnily enough, it is called orange peel fungus.
It's very bright orange, but I would never have noticed that until you pointed it out. I would have walked past it.
Well, hopefully most folk will, so it'll stay there for a good while. In fact, here's another one. I hadn't noticed it growing out of the base of the stump. Dark brown top and quite white underneath, mm-hmm. with a big rounded whitish edge. Mm-hmm. Very characteristic fungi, and that one is specific on tree stumps and old trees and things like that. That's a notorious tree parasite and saprophyte. That is, it not only kills the tree but helps to rot it as well. Sometimes called heart rot or root rot.
Okay.
Because it does so much damage. In fact, quite often when trees blow down, they find that thing, which is why the trees then blow down quite easily. Just looking in the grass. Oh, there's some here.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yes, now, those ones have certainly seen better days.
Yes, they're rather
blackish.
Black, yes.
Yes. Let's see. They've got a stalk, a black stalk, simply because they're dead. Feeling them, they're half dried out. They're almost mummified. That's a very characteristic one that grows on grass, not necessarily associated with trees, but grass like this, and in underneath generally trees, sort of wooded areas. And in fact, actually, it's called a blackening brittlegill. It's white or brown to start with.
Oh, right, right, wow.
And then it turns black and dries out. In fact, you can find it in spring even.
And what does its presence tell us about the kind of the land or the soil or the conditions around here? Does it tell us anything?
Yes, it does. In fact, the fact that we've got quite a number of fungi just looking around means that this place hasn't been fertilised, it hasn't been sprayed. No herbicides, no pesticides, which are generally death to fungi. Mm. And in fact, here's some more. Ah, and here, these are the blackening brittlegill, not yet black.
Oh, yes.
That's the way they look to start with.
So that looks a bit more like, a sort of mushroom you might buy in the
yes.
supermarket. Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, you wouldn't want to buy that one in the supermarket. No, most fungi aren't edible. Mm-hmm. A few are poisonous. A few are deadly poisonous. There is one literally called, and for good reason, called death cap.
Mm-hmm. With that in mind, why on earth do you have such a fascination with fungi?
Well, my answer is they're there, why not? But yeah, I've been interested in fungi for years, and just gradually picking it up is not something that you necessarily learn all that quickly, but there are various groups around that you can join. The trouble is this year, not surprisingly, has been with its very strange conditions. We've actually not had any official outings at all,
yeah.
Although individual members or families have been going out and finding some very nice things. Because as far as fungi is concerned, with the amount of rain we've had, it's been a fantastic year.
A good year.
Ah, this is what I was looking for.
Oh, yes. Oh, wow.
If I hold it out so you can see it, it looks like a little ear.
It does, yes.
And in fact, if I sugar it, you can see it shake.
Oh, yes.
Jelly ear.
Wow, yeah.
Characteristic on dead wood. Look at these great big things underneath.
Oh, yeah, wow.
And they are brackets growing sideways out, dark on top because that's of age, although the younger ones underneath are brownish. And if you look right underneath, you can see they're white.
Oh, yes.
So that's one of the artist's fungus, as they're called, because if you break it off, we won't. Much prefer leave them. You can actually draw on the surface.
No.
Just run your fingernail on it, and you can play noughts and crosses or something like that.
Oh, quite apt, the artist fungus, since we're here at Hospital Field, which has obviously got such a big history and connection with art.
Yes.
But you're hosting walks here. Tell me a bit about that.
We've got a walk on Saturday, this coming Saturday, just to explore the area and see what fungi there are. It's not a site I know well myself, but just looking around, you can, even at this time of year, you can find 15 or 20 species. And we've seen just in 5 minutes, there's a number of them around.
That was Jim Cook there from the Tayside and Fife Fungal Group. And if you're in Angus, there are still spaces on that walk for later today. We've put a link on our website for more details.
Yeah, quite a few people getting the mystery bird wrong, which is quite gratifying. Tom in Turnberry said, is it a robin? And he's aged 5, so he should know. Sadly, Tom, it's not. He's up helping his dad on the farm.
Good man.
Greg in Gateshead says, a song thrush, doing the morning stretches before going out cycling by the mighty Tyne. And Robin Peterhead says, the bird is a reed wobbler. Warbler. No, well, no, it's not, sadly, but a lot of good guesses. And one of these ones is guaranteed an email to get read because the headline is Great Show. Guys, this is the best show on radio. Seriously, love my Saturday mornings. A wee link back to Scotland. Loving the recycling idea from Forrest. Well, if you want, we'll parcel it up and send it on to you. That's Neil Moncur from Stirling, but now living in the depths of darkest Anglesey.
I'll see that and raise it. Kjell Fransson says, hi from Sweden. Greatly enjoy listening to your programme every week. Hoping to get over to Scotland next summer to our son's graduation at Stirling University. Looking forward to seeing more of beautiful Scotland then. And Kjell thinks that the bird of the week is the red-breasted flycatcher. Listen, Kjell, you are overestimating us. God love you. No, that's way too smart for us. And he adds, wishing you a wonderful festive season. Janet in Larbert says, morning, it is Ben Moore. The fernery there, we were talking about ferns earlier, the fernery is wonderful. It's a magical place. I visited just after it opened. And Eileen in Troon says, been laughing so much this morning. Really enjoying the show. No clue what the mystery bird is. Well, honesty is the best policy, I reckon, Eileen, so good for you.
What's she finding to laugh at? This is a serious programme.
Cutting edge, current affairs type programme.
Give you a clue. It's very strongly associated with water and not the salty kind. 0808 592 95 00. Now, this time of year is associated with the granting of wishes. Fairy godmothers out in full force. But back in the summer, I was in the Morven area of the West Highlands, just opposite Mull, and I came upon Alistair Firth, and he took me to a fascinating stone.
This is Clachna Cree, which is the boundary stone in Gaelic, but in English it's called the wishing stone.
Now, I was driving along on the Morven side of the Sound of Mull, and suddenly you come across this massive natural feature. I mean, describe it to me, it's incredible.
Well, you can't miss it, can you? It's the it's a basalt dike that's probably around 60 million years old, and it's got this massive hole in it. So at some point, those rocks just fell out when it was probably below sea level during the last ice age, so maybe around that time.
So it was originally, you must have had rocks the size of it, and it squeezed through the sandstone or whatever to leave this massive wall.
Aye, all of Morven is basalt, so this is just a harder bit of one of the lava flows that's been left after the rest of it's been eroded.
And it's just standing on its own. It's maybe about 100 feet long and 40, something like that, feet high, in this massive hole about 10, 12 feet high and 6 feet broad. You know, it's an impressive thing.
It's an impressive thing, and one of the things you really notice about it is that it's white. And that white isn't the colour of the rock. That's the colour of the lichens that are growing on the rock. So you've got all these different lichens festooning it, if you like, dripping off it.
And it's called the Boundary Stone, as you said. What's it the boundary of?
Well, it's an ancient boundary. And obviously, for anybody that lived here, they would see this as a marker between different territories, if you like. And where we're standing now is probably not Scotland. Scotland's the other side of the rock. We're in Pictland.
Wow, so this is the border between Scotland and Pictland.
Legend has it, yeah. And more recently, it's been a parish boundary between two different parishes, which now are one. I'm standing in the Killundin parish at the moment.
And you were suggesting me to earlier on, it was also a clan boundary.
Yeah, the clan MacLean, who have some of the lands around here, use this as one of the markers between their boundaries. For some people, it would be a sign that you can see from the sea. So that's maybe why it was such a distinctive boundary stone. This is the old road that we're on here. It's the modern road as well. But in the past, when the funeral processions were going between Drimnin and Loch Allen, this would be a place what they would stop at. And so we have every funeral party would build their small cairn.
Is that what we're seeing behind us, all the stones?
Aye, these stones have been placed here by the parties coming through, so they get a stone from the shore and put that down as a kind of blessing.
So it's a stopping point for those carrying coffins. It's a boundary between Scotland and England, a parish boundary and a clan boundary. But there's more.
There's more, because it's got these associations with wishes and having a wish granted. So there's a small burn just down from here where legend has it, if you take a mouthful of the water from that burn and then pass through this hole three times without touching the sides with your hands, your wish will be granted. It's a very difficult thing to do, though.
You tried it?
I have tried it.
Did it work?
Some of it worked. We haven't got to the final granting of the wish yet, but we'll see what happens.
But it's a work in progress.
Well, I think all wishes are a work in progress, aren't they?
But I'm looking at it, and the first step is the height of my chest. Well, and how do you get up there without using your hands?
There is a way. Even without being assisted by someone else, you can do it. And I've done it a few times, but I did used to climb quite a lot. So the first move is a bit, it's not intuitive. You have to kind of shimmy your body without using your hands.
Meanwhile, carrying a mouthful of water.
Yeah, you have to remember that you shouldn't swallow once you step onto the top as well.
Start again.
Yep, come round and start again.
I can't even imagine doing that. I'm holding a microphone, so that's not going to happen.
Once you get in there, you throw your body up.
So there, you got your left.
Oh, like that.
Wow!
But I don't think I did it in these boots either.
Wait, you got closer than I got.
Like that.
And you're up.
But I use my elbow.
Elbows done. That's still pretty impressive. Okay, my wishes are going to remain unfulfilled.
Explain that to me again. How was he trying to get on top of the rock?
Well, it's a good 4 feet up, mm-hmm. and he just puts his leg on one rock and just swings up. If you've ever seen climbers or boulderers, they do it all the time, and you know, they get their legs up so high, and it was just an impressive thing to see. I couldn't even climb up using my hands, so it's no wishes for me. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. Is it terribly far from the road?
No, it's right beside the road.
Well, in which case, why don't you just take a trampette with you? Take a run at it and leap onto the top of the stone with a mouthful of water, and your wishes will come true.
Well, I stood there for quite a while waiting for a guy in a cherry picker to come along, but sadly it didn't.
They have a weight restriction, sadly. Anyway, you're listening to The Doors.
It's a fascinating thing.
It is a fascinating thing. You're listening to The Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElruth. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yep, you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the free Scotland Outdoors podcast, internationally acclaimed, available from BBC Sounds. Every week we say this, but it's true. We like hearing where you listen to the podcast, because folk listen to our podcast in some weird and wonderful places. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Brian Rendell in County Durham did. He said, "Dear Mark, Ewan and Helen,
and everybody else. Thank you for your wonderfully informative and friendly programme. I feel that it's like listening to mates chatting about natural passions. I subscribe to your podcast and find it a calming and mindful meandering for my troubled mind. Thank you for assisting me... Oh, this is nice. Thank you for assisting me in overcoming my anxiety disorder.
Yeah, we always holiday in Scotland, he goes on to say, and you keep my mind bending northwards. I love that, bending northwards. We follow up on the places and areas you've covered, too many to mention. Your insights and care of the Scottish natural environment is inspiring and compassionate. Thanks again. That's Brian Rendell, a County Durham listener.
Willie the farmer and Deb Breakins thinks the mystery bird is a tree creeper. Colin and Kirk Newton thinks the mystery bird is a goldcrest. Great programme, by the way. Hugh and Orkney says, could it be a sand martin? Gary and Pennycook says, sand martin, second guess. Paul from Hamilton, is the mystery bird an oyster catcher? Oh, no, Paul. Margaret and Huntley says, nuthatch. Andrew and Hoy. They've typed this down as Andrew Hoy in Orkney. I suspect it's Andrew, comma, Hoy, Orkney. I think it's this week's bird is a sand martin, only from your clues so far. Nope. Stephen Cumbernauld, is the mystery bird a bullfinch? Christine got it right. Christine Ewer from Edinburgh got it right. Pat Breakin says yellow wagtail. And John and Lois Rothy Norman. This every week in life, they say, good morning, fair soggy Rothy. It can't rain all the time in Rothy Norman, surely. Is the mystery bird a sand martin?
It's been raining.
It's raining just now.
Yeah.
I am watching the water running down the firewood even as we speak. Anyway, the mystery bird, Ewan.
Yeah, we're still time to guess the mystery bird before we dip into the answer. Here's a wee listen. So get in touch. There was a clue there if you're listening carefully. You can email out of doors or give us a call 0808 592 95 00.
Rural homelessness is not a subject that comes up very often on this programme, but according to figures recently published, it has doubled in the past 2 years. Raina Wynne and her husband Moth found themselves losing their Welsh farm a few years ago, which was devastating in itself, but followed very swiftly by some even more terrible news. The way they dealt with it, though, was remarkable, and has resulted in Raina writing two best-selling books about the story. The first, The Salt Path, which is just riveting. And second one, The Wild Silence, you know, equally attention-grabbing. She describes here what happened when they were made homeless.
We were given a week to leave the property, so it was in that awful week of trying to pack 20 years of life into boxes that Moth had what we thought was going to be just a routine hospital appointment. But it was anything but a routine day, because he was given a diagnosis of an illness that has no treatment, no cure. It was a neurodegenerative disease called corticobasal degeneration, something we'd never heard of. And is quite, maybe if not rare, then certainly uncommon. And we were absolutely in shock when we got that diagnosis, something that we absolutely had not thought of for one moment could be the outcome of that day. And then to be told that there was absolutely nothing that could be done. And the best recommendation that the consultant could give us was that Moth should just try not to get too tired and be careful on the stairs.
It was such an eye-opener reading your first book, The Salt Path. I think actually I read it in two sittings because it was just so compelling. You find yourself in that dreadful situation with nowhere to live, no money, deeply unwell husband, but you choose to undertake a 600-mile walk. Tell us about the Southwest Path.
Yeah, it's maybe not the most responsible or reasonable response to that week, is it? But we decided to walk the Southwest Coast Path, really, from the moment we were about to leave the house, when the bailiffs were knocking at the door and we were hiding under the stairs just because we weren't ready to take that step out of the doorway. And I spotted a book in a packing case by Mark Warrington. It was called 500 Mile Walkies, a story about a young man that walked the Southwest Coast Path that follows the whole of the coastline of the southwest of England with his dog. And it just seemed like the most obvious thing to do, just fill a rucksack and go for a walk. But I think we didn't realise at that point that actually it's 630 miles, not 500. But I think the thing we didn't realise was that it has an ascent that's equivalent to climbing Everest nearly four times. When we read Coast Path, I think we thought it just more or less followed the beach. But it turned out to be really one of the most difficult paths in the country that is constantly down to sea level, back up to a few hundred feet, back down to sea level. It's just a remorseless path over headlands and beaches, through woodlands and coombs. Goes all the way from Minehead in Somerset, through the north of Devon, round the whole coastline of Cornwall, South Devon, and then ends in Poole in Dorset. So quite an epic walk, really.
And the constant presence of the sea as well. You actually write about how you two became salted.
That's right. I mean, there is something incredible about that path. I mean, it might not be the Highlands of Scotland. It might not have that absolute remote wildness of Scotland, but there is something incredibly wild about the path. You've got the sort of ordinary everyday world on one side, but then the sea constantly, that endless horizon of the sea on the other side, always. It's a strip of wilderness, really, that's apart from that ordinary, well, not ordinary, but the normal, what you think of as the southwest, of a place of holidays and beaches and caravan parks. It's sort of apart from that, and it's as if the wildlife of the area has been driven and concentrated into this strip of wilderness that follows the coast.
So I think that the proper scientific term for the area and the coast, the sort of intertidal zone, is the liminal zone. And that's kind of the reality of the existence you were entering. It's extraordinary. But bearing in mind that the advice you had been given by the medical profession, or for one Moth had been given, was try not to get too tired and be careful on the stairs. Taking this path was really quite a leap, but it helped. It helped him.
You know, it was just a real problem at the start because he was struggling to get in and out of the tent. He was struggling to put his rucksack on without being in pain. Weeks later, maybe 200 miles later, we started to notice that his walking was just a little bit more stable, that his mind, his thinking was just a bit clearer. And I think we really knew that something was changing. At the end of what had been sort of a perfect summer's day, where there'd not been a breath of wind, and we went down to this little cove, Porthos Cove, and the sea was just like so flat, it was like treacle. We went out, we swam in the bay, and there were dolphins in the bay, and it was just like, if we hadn't been homeless and Moth was ill, then it would have been a perfect day. We pitched the tent at the very edge of the beach, way above the high tide line, and thought we were going to have a beautiful night there. Until about 3 o'clock in the morning, we did. But then at 3 in the morning, I opened the tent flaps to find that the tide that we thought we were way beyond the high tide line was actually only a metre from the tent, and it was still rising. So we had to jump out of the tent and grab everything that we could. And we picked the tent up whole, still fully erected, and ran up the beach with it, holding it above our heads, and dropped it down at the foot of these shaly cliffs. And as we dropped it down, we realised that Moth had just run up the beach, holding a tent above his head. And only those weeks earlier, he'd been struggling to put his coat on without help. And he'd just run up that beach with that tent. And we realised then that something absolutely unbelievable was happening. He was seeing an improvement in his health that he'd been told was impossible. And in that moment there, on that beach, in the darkness, it just felt as if some sort of miracle was happening.
Raina Wynne there. Salvator Ambulando, St. Augustine, walking will solve it. I mean, and the full story is really quite extraordinary. It continues to have some astonishing twists and turns. It's on the latest edition of Scotland Outdoors, available now on BBC Sounds. just a great story. Now the moment you've all been waiting for, the reveal of this week's mystery bird, getting it right with the following, and this is only a small sample because we've got lots and lots and lots of right answers, so apologies if you're not included here. Gordon in Zurich says, is it a dipper? I hope it's the dipper. I cycle a mountain forest route along the Seal River to Zug. It's about 60 kilometres round trip each Saturday and Sunday, where I stop for a short break. My small, white-breasted friend darts from rock to rock when I stop to say hello. Thank you for bringing our Scottish countryside to life. Thanks for that, Gordon. We also got correct answers from Alan from Selkirk, Lorna Aberfeldy, Susan from Spot, Alan from Selkirk twice. Look at that. Fred Armadale West Lothian, Doug in Olness, and Patricia Blair Gowrie. Good stuff. So, the bird, of course, is a dipper. Delightful wee bird, now quite common in the central belt. But this is a bird that's actually quite special to you.
Yeah, in my last year at university in Edinburgh, I was studying this bird for my thesis, and it meant really hard work, spending a blazing summer wandering up and down a wee river near Haddington, a tributary of the Tyne. And I was trying to establish territory size in relation to food abundance. And I fell in love with them. The sun beats down on Lethem Burn, tumbling and twisting to join the Tyne. The day is hot, the clouds are few, the water sings. This day is mine. The riverbank, the riverbed, the brook, the stream, the burn, the trout, the eel, the salmon fry. The bird eyes every turn. Apron of white, a chestnut slash, and eyes, the eyes that know. Through currents deep and eddies twist, the water crawl braves the flow. The bob, the dip, the bow, the bending of the knee, the flash, the streak, the dart, the grab, the bird that has the key. The key, that key, the key that opens up the riverbed, the caddis nymph, the fly of May, the bounties of the deep. The dipper dips and swims upstream against current, tide and surge to seek the food, the wildlife store, and nature's gifts to reap. In Scotland's rivers and moorland streams, this bird of ours does churn. The dipper swims through morning mists and flies through Highland Burn. It looks like a wren. It sings kind of like a wren. But the dipper is special, very special. There's nothing else like it. The Burney Baker from its white apron, the water craw, and S. Cocky from the Gaelic for waterfall, behind which it makes its nest. It flits from rock to rock, hangs on branches over water. But the thing that marks the dipper out, above all other birds, is that it can swim underwater. Not like penguins or waterfowl. The dipper has no webbing on its feet, just the sheer power of muscle. Their wings are relatively short but strong, and that enables them to be used as flippers underwater. They angle the wings to act as a hydrofoil, keeping them anchored to the riverbed. And the feet, like our hands, they can grab rocks, keeping them submerged in swift water. They have a plumage with a large preen gland for waterproofing the feathers. And their eyes have well-developed focus muscles that can change the curvature of the lens to enhance underwater vision. And they have a nasal flap to prevent the water entering the nostrils. It's the Norwegian national bird, maybe because of its mystical past in Norse culture. The dipper spends most of its time on the ground near waterfalls, so it was in close contact with the dark Gulkfar, the dark elves, the fae folk who lived underground. Now, the black elves didn't look kindly on humans, and they had the power, and the water craw had their ear. The dipper could plot with them, take revenge on anyone who dared disturb the nest or the young ones. So the dipper was a bird who was left alone and avoided at all costs. Sadly, in Victorian Scotland, they were anything but left alone. Viewed as vermin by those seeking salmon as sport, the dipper's underwater activities were seen as a threat to salmon eggs. Sixpence per dipper was the bounty paid to those who caught, trapped or shot
these delightful insect-eating tiny birds. Tens of thousands were killed in the highlands and the islands, where they're still rare to this day. And it wasn't just Victorian Scotland. The Cyprus race of the white-throated dipper is now extinct. And in the Atlas Mountains, dippers are claimed to have enhanced sexual properties, which has pushed them to the edge of survival. These are delightful little birds and an essential part of our countryside. The dipper, the escocky, and the water crow. What a bird.
Ewan with the answer to this week's mystery bird there, the dipper. You know, the more we work together, the more coincidences that kind of crop up. The very first bird that I was really fascinated by was the dipper, and it was just at the Polner Dam. I watched it for hours.
Oh no, it's getting scary now.
It is getting scary now. Anyway, in the run-up to Christmas, we thought it might be a very good idea to take a slightly different look at the gifts the three wise men brought to Mary and Joseph. Last week, we looked at gold. Today, frankincense. And my story starts in northern Ethiopia.
Well, it's not quite light yet. It's very early in the morning. But as you come into this compound, you see what look like Dutch barns with corrugated iron roofs. And it's only when you get closer that you realise that under those roofs, protected from the elements, are the most incredible monuments, church-sized buildings, not made out of pieces of rock, but carved from one piece of rock. All the rock surrounding them was cut away, and what was left was carved into these churches. Binyam is my guide here. Binyam, what church is this we're heading towards?
This is called Beit HaMadehani Alam, means the Redeemer of, or the Saver of the world. And it's the biggest and the largest rock-hewn church in the world.
It's just beautifully done.
The type of the rock is volcanic tuff rock and built up in 23 years.
I did some research on this, and academics believe it would have taken 40,000 people working full-time to actually carve out these churches. But the local belief is that it wasn't just humans that were working on these.
Yeah, it was by the help of angels.
So the humans worked the day shift and the angels worked the night shift?
Yeah, yeah, that's what the legendary story says, you know.
The rock here is actually polished by thousands and thousands of feet. And as we step inside, there are rugs on the floor. This is just amazing.
And where we are now is that we use for a mass. Uh-huh. And the third separation is for service, you know, yeah. Chanting rooms where priests and deacons sit around and chanting whenever there is a celebration, you know, with a drum and sistrums.
I'm trying to work out, I mean, this church is about, it's bigger than I would say your average Scottish kirk. This would probably hold somewhere in the region of 400, 500 people.
Yes.
This
yes.
is carved out of one
yeah,
piece of rock.
Exactly. Yeah.
The pillar you are standing with your back against is
original.
3 foot by 3 foot. And the ceiling itself, as you say, carved out with hammer and chisel, is probably 30 feet above us.
Right.
This is the most extraordinary building I've ever been in my life. I was sitting amongst the priests who were worshipping, and you were saying that the building itself is sacred, and I just noticed that to a height of about five and a half foot all the way around the walls are polished.
Yeah.
Several million kisses of devotion.
Yeah, it's actually kisses by the community, you know, or for those who come as a pilgrimage. But this is mostly once a year, which is on January, which is on Ethiopian Christmas. We have thousands of pilgrims coming from different sides of the world, especially from different sides of Ethiopia. So, and it's well celebrated in Lalibela to celebrate the Ethiopian Christmas.
That was me in the rock-hewn churches of Lalibela in northern Ethiopia back in 2006.
The churches are amazing. They're a World Heritage Site, and they've been in continuous daily use since they were built 800 years ago. The same buildings, the same prayers, the same chants, even the same Bibles. So what I was seeing back then was literally medieval faith in the 21st century. But some things in Lalibela go back much further than that. A cold coming we had of it. Just the worst time of the year for a journey. And such a long journey. The ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter. And the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. That's the opening verse of T.S. Eliot's poem, The Journey of the Magi. Now, the Magi are often described as the three kings, or the three wise men. Biblical scholars now believe that they were probably Persian or Arabian astrologers who charted the stars and attached significance to their movements. There was a new star in the sky about that time. Reports as to precisely when vary, but it would have been enough to get their attention, particularly as there was a prophecy that a king of kings would come from Judea. And according to the Gospel of Matthew, the Magi came bearing gifts, chapter 2, verse 11. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. Now, gold is obvious enough, and myrrh we'll talk about next week. But frankincense comes from a tree, Boswellia sacra, found in the Arabian Peninsula, Oman and Yemen, and northeastern Africa, Somaliland. Boswellia grows in hot, hard desert places. Local people make cuts in the bark of the tree and it weeps sap, which hardens into the tears of frankincense, which was used for perfumes and as an incense. Which takes me back to Lalibela. There I was, very early in the morning, in the Church of St. George. The sun had come up and was shining through the open stone doorway. There was a priest standing beside the door carrying the cross of St. George. Various icons glowed in brilliant colours on the walls, and there was a massive Bible, greasy with age, sitting on a lectern. Now, probably nothing had changed in this scene for 800 years. I felt like holding my breath in case it vanished. One of the priests reached down into a small brass bowl and took out a handful of pink and orange crystals. They looked a bit like fragments of rosy quartz, but they were slightly soft, almost gummy to the touch. He put them in my hand. I smiled at him, he smiled back, and I asked my guide, Binion, "What is this stuff?" And he replied, "I think you call it frankincense." I'd genuinely had no idea what it was, and for some reason it really moved me. I wrapped the tears in a tissue and stored them in a side pocket of my rucksack, and they came back to Scotland with me. Now, my parents are devout Christians, and every year, just to remind folk what they believe Christmas is all about, they put up a nativity scene. When I got back, I gave them the little tissue parcel, and now, every year, one of the Magi in their nativity scene bears a gift. Real tears of frankincense.
If you get the chance, go to the rock-hewn churches of Lalibela, because, I mean, they are just extraordinary. But failing that, look them up online. What an effort went into the making of those things. Just extraordinary.
But you will be giving your parents some myrrh and some gold this Christmas to go with the frankincense.
We were just talking about this yesterday, full enough. My mum was saying, "Oh, we can stick gold in one and the other ones and what have you." But myrrh, myrrh. I said, we'll talk about myrrh next week. I'm not sure there's as much to talk about with myrrh, and it's not a particularly cheerful subject. But as I said, that'll crop up in Scotland on Out of Doors next week. Sadly,
I'd be very surprised if you don't manage to get 8 minutes out of it.
Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. Don't forget the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is published at noon today. Next week's midweek podcast, you and I hear from naturalist Chris Packham and his stepdaughter Megan McCubbin. A really robust chap about how many aspects of the countryside is managed in the UK. But from all of the team here in Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.